Hello. I know people are still making their way in, but I'm going ahead and making a start right at 6:30 so that we can more or less stick to time. A few just administrative and sort of publicity announcements to begin with. Tonight's talk is hosted by the LSE U.S. Center and also the Department of Government. We've got an event hashtag for those of you on your Twitter feed, so #LSEUSMidterms, appropriately named. So that's the formal stuff. So it's my pleasure to introduce Eric Busey, who has a rather long title here, Marshall and Charlene Formby Regents Professor of Strategic Communication, say that quickly five times, at Texas Tech University. And very happily, he is a visiting senior fellow in the government department and has been for over the summer and will be until December. So we're very happy to have him. He's author of a multiple prize-winning book, Image Bite Politics, News and the Visual Framing of Elections, sort of on a little twist on soundbite politics, and it's Image Bite Politics. Great book. I've read most of it, not all of it. Eric sent an e version to it, but I liked it so much I went out to Amazon and bought my own copy. There's nothing like having your own copy, so I strongly recommend it. He's also edited, for those of you who are into methodology, Sourcebook for Political Communication Research, which sort of defines analytical techniques for nonverbal gurus out there. He was editor for many years of the journal Politics and the Life Sciences. And more recently, his work and his articles has focused on something called media biopolitics. So there's a term to take away with you tonight. Media biopolitics, which effectively focuses on nonverbal or the effect of nonverbal behavior. So facial expressions, vocal cues, gestures in U.S. presidential debates and the effect of those on viewers. On a personal note, Eric has been a bit of a tutor to me in learning this fascinating field of nonverbal communication or nonverbal behavior and the role that it plays in shaping attitudes and preferences. So the agenda for tonight is that Eric will speak for about 40 minutes, and then we have a discussant. So David Smith is our discussant, and he is the British Academic Visiting Fellow here at the LSE, and he is Senior Lecturer in American Politics at the U.S. Studies Center at University of Sydney. So he is going to say a bit about Eric's talk, and then we will open things up to Q&A, and we'll just kind of see how we go on the Q&A, but I'll try to take as many questions as we can. We'll get to the format for that later, but without further ado, I will invite you to help me welcome Eric.
Thanks for that, Cheryl. Let me get the right presentation up here. And here we go. So just a brief apology. First of all, I don't have a Halloween costume on, but I want to thank you for being here on Halloween night. There'll still be time afterwards. Secondly, I'm going to start out with a term that's a little bit off color. I hope it's not too much. It's in the dictionary, and it's in very common use these days. So without any further ado, let's get to it. So if you look at the images here of these girls, they're adorable, and I have some video I'm going to show you. But both of them are not spouting bullshit. One of them probably is. Can you just tell? Do you have a sense of who might be? Just a show of hands real quick. Does one look like she might be a little? Okay, so, right. We're already starting to form judgments on the basis just of an image, without any sound, without much really in-depth, what we classically call information. One actually knows what she's talking about. It's demonstrated in the video. For other, an imaginary and stylistic strategy kind of emerges. You might call it a nascent communication logic, and she seems pretty practiced at it. Let's take a look here.
I think a piece of cake means, like, it's funny.
So I should preface this by saying this is on the dictionary.com site, and they have fun videos about language and about definitions and words. So these are some idioms, which are kind of linguistic peculiarities in how younger people process them and understand them.
I think a piece of cake means, like, it's really easy,
What could it mean if someone says that's going to cost you an arm and a leg?
That means, like, a lot of things. Or actually, an arm. You have to fully have to have the arm. It's, like, dangerous.
All right, close, but she's having fun, right? So I want to open with this for a couple reasons. Number one, it's kind of an analogy of what's going on today in political discussion. We actually have some people kind of dealing in facts and other people kind of making it up. Secondly, it shows us kind of the state of discourse today, which is not always purely information driven. So as a backdrop for today's politics, and one reason why I do like to study nonverbal communication is that it gets away from words, which can be kind of easily misused. So what's interesting is we get to university and we really prioritize language, what's written, the logic that's on the page, the in-depth argument you can make. And yet in everyday life, we're interacting constantly through our sensory system and through nonverbal communication. So I don't know if you're aware of this really kind of interesting book. It was by a retired philosopher from Princeton named Harry Frankfurt. And it was called On Bullshit. And it's become very influential even in the social sciences because it fits so much of what communication is today. And his argument is that, you know, it kind of courses throughout society and in discussions. And it's really an unavoidable aspect of modern society given the uncertainty and the kind of challenges that prevail. And so it allows people to kind of seem like they're saying something when they're not. Now, there's an interesting distinction between, you know, what he would call BS and what other people would call lies. And it's kind of the distinction between misinformation and disinformation. It depends on your intention. And so if we go to definitions of it, first of all, it can be both a noun and a verb. So there is such a thing as words that kind of don't have any meaning. That's bullshit. But then also you can bullshit somebody with words that have no meaning. But unlike lying, BS is marked by an indifference to the truth. So I have debates with some of my colleagues about when Trump speaks, and the Washington Post has now documented he's up to about 7.5 lies per day. Is he aware of it, or is he kind of blissfully ignorant? So is it a lie in his mind, or is it bullshit? We don't know because we're not in his mind, but I'd love to be in that back room and listen in on that discussion. When this happens, other people have to kind of recreate or repurpose the narrative for him so that it somehow fits a logical flow, because there still seems to be a demand in society for some kind of cohesive narrative. So in comes the press secretary. And even she's got some interesting expressions at times. I would argue I haven't seen these kind of expressions ever on a press secretary. Even though there's been historically a lot of dodging and artful kind of deflections of questions, it's reached a different level. And so A professor of practice at Arizona State, Dan Gilmore, puts it this way. Politicians have always told some lies. This is different. We've now have a war basically against honest journalism, facts, freedom of expression. The use of misinformation is strategy, but with an end game, right? So this isn't all for naught. There's an end game here, which is very similar to propaganda, and that is to confuse. So the more you kind of throw up into the air and the more rapidly you do it, the harder it is to keep track of what they just said before, what the real kind of policy agenda might be, things going on in the background or kind of longer term. So they want the public to become so confused by what's true and what's false that people give up on the idea that journalism can even help sort things out. Let's say that's a new place for Western society and culture. So what to do in this state of affairs? Do we continue just to study the words, which we know are coming out highly inaccurately? Do we try to hold politicians who are either engaging in bullshit or deliberately lying accountable when they don't seem to care too much? Or do we turn to another form of communication, which actually might end up being a little more influential, which are nonverbal indicators? So this is my interest in really, you know, is just reflecting on this. 20, 30 years ago, it seemed pretty out there to study this. Social psychologists have looked at nonverbal communication for a long time. Darwin documented the expression of emotion in man and the animals, as he called it. And so it has been a topic of systematic inquiry for quite some time. But I think these days it has even more kind of explanatory leverage. And so nonverbals act as a heuristic or a judgmental shortcut for people to basically make inferences about a communicator. And so whether that's a trait, it could be a long-term kind of characteristic, whether you think the person is honest or trustworthy, or it could be situational. Is the person acting appropriate? Are they credible in this particular context now? And it's been increasingly documented, the effects of nonverbal communication, through a series of really innovative studies in psychology and organizational behavior called thin slice forecasts. Basically, that means you can show people a very short snippet of video, whether it's a politician or whether it's any other kind of influencer, you could say. It could even be just a photograph. And on the basis, again, going back to the original slide I show, of just a photograph, you can ask people in a political context, who do you think the winner's going to be of an election? And people you don't know, that you've never seen. So this was done by a team out of Cornell University, and they showed gubernatorial candidates across the states to people who weren't familiar with them, only photos, and they asked, can you predict who's going to win the election? And it turns out people can at a rate better than chance. Now, we haven't figured out all the mechanisms of just how this operates, but we know for one, that competence kind of emerges as a mediating trait. So if a face looks more competent or if a video conveys more competence, even within 10 seconds, that will kind of moderate someone's judgment and leading to an accurate prediction. Now, here's something really amazing. We've done studies where you have full motion video with the sound on, full motion video, garbled sound, video, no sound. Can you guess which is the most accurate condition for predicting an election winner? Garbled, full sound, no sound. No sound. I mean, this must be an educated audience, right? Yeah. What?
You're reading.
Oh, okay. You're reading ahead. Right. So the sound confuses matters. Now think about the way society's organized. Talk, 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 talk. Now, I'm a former English major. I was a print reporter before that. And now I'm starting to question some of these kind of fundamental assumptions of communication or of our values and what we think is really the most important thing going on. So we turn to someone who I consider to be a pretty effective communicator. You know, this is aside from politics. I think Reagan was also very effective, right? And they called Reagan the Teflon president. No real lasting criticism could stick. Well, why? Well, in part because he had this winning smile, and it wasn't just a fake smile. It was a smile that involved and implicated all regions of his face, and it looked genuine. Yes, he was an actor previously. But this is what people saw in real time. So Bill Clinton had this kind of natural ability. And so here he is in response to the L.A. riots, which break out in April of 92. I was there at the time. There was, I would say, pretty much mass panic. Clinton's trying to reassure. He's trying to show some empathy. And he's even using gestures to show the gap can narrow. We can bring people together. He's not saying, some people are over here, some people are over there. I'm afraid. We should be outraged. He's not doing any of that. He's doing a lot of work with his face, with his hands. Now, this ends up being, I think, valuable heuristically as social information. So it's not classical factual information we'd find on a page or in a math equation, but it has a lot of meaning for social animals like humans. So through expressive displays, they evoke, first of all, a lot of emotion, a lot of evaluation, as I've been talking about. It could be favorable or unfavorable to the source. And these kind of initial impressions, which happen very rapidly, can affect attitudes and longer dispositions to action. And this can, again, be whether the leader's voice is heard or whether they're only seen. Now we get to a consideration of gestures and other kind of symbolic communication. And the open palm display is almost always a very positive kind of tension-reducing, non-aggressive, positive greeting. It contributes to bonding, and it reduces kind of, antagonistic impulses. Here, Obama's in front of a crowd of about 300,000 in Berlin before the 2008 election, and essentially that's what he's communicating. I'm your friend. We can do this together. So leadership has a large nonverbal component. There's another interesting feature of this, which is if you want to find the most dominant individual, and this works with media too, just look at who's watching the central figure. You don't even have to look to see who it is. Just follow everybody else, and who are they focused on? Now, here's a interesting animal fact. This works in humans, and it works in non-human primate bands. So the dominant individual gets the most visual attention. I think in the United States, since about 2015, this has been carried to an extreme, in part for commercial purposes, but it holds up. And it's true in debates, and it's true in social groupings, and it's true on the playground, and it's true in everyday life. So why all these visual effects? Well, here's where I think political scientists and psychologists and students of communication and media actually could do with a little bit of neurology and physiology, which is there's a region in the brain called the visual cortex. And you think, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. We've got eyes, and really the process happens deep in the brain. It evolved over evolution, and it's very robust as a predictor. There's been some great work on the stratification and diversification of animals once eyes started to appear in animals in the sea. And the minute you have a kind of an entity with eyes, you suddenly turn the world of sea creatures from these things that kind of move slow and kind of bump into each other into predators and prey. And with that, you get this huge diversification called the Cambrian explosion of all these different kind of biological types that we have now. So we think, oh, visual cortex, okay, that makes sense. Now think about it. Going back to what we emphasize in polite and urbane society, which is the words, the facts, the written kind of content on the page. Is there a reading cortex? No such thing. Reading, even language, is very new in evolutionary terms. It goes back, we can't even date it entirely. First of all, there aren't good written records going back more than 5,000 years. And, it's hard to document anatomically because part of it depends on the position of the larynx and then what happens with some of the fibers and the different parts of the body that just decompose. See, it's really hard to pinpoint language. It could be 50,000 years new. It could be 200,000 years. Maybe as old as 500,000 years. A lot of people doubt that. But what we do know for sure is that vision has been around and has guided animal behavior for millennia, and going back all the way to early sea life. Okay, so let's take some images here. Would anybody doubt that the top image has scientific value, is informational, and is telling us a story about an incoming weather event? Lots of information. How many people are willing to give similar credibility to the lower panel of images? Right. They seem routine. We want to discount it. We're not really getting much out of that. And yet, this is the automatic kind of visual almost benefit, which is as we're watching mediated politics, we're just constantly processing information and making inferences whether they're fully available on a conscious level or not. So my argument is like radar images of weather patterns and incoming storms, political visuals can serve as reliable sources of information if you're aware of what you're watching or if you're just a little bit cognizant of how they do have some persuasive value. Here's the other thing for the mass audience, which is they require minimal literacy. You don't have to have a political schema. You don't have to read the great philosophers to understand visually what's going on. They enable quick inferences, and they even equalize some knowledge gaps. So if you ask political knowledge questions and you include a visual, suddenly a lot of people do much better, and it equalizes gaps we see between ethnicity, between gender, and even socioeconomic status. So if you want to ask a fair question, you include a visual. Now here's Reagan with his trademark smile. And if you notice around the eyes, he's got those crow's feet. And, it's a sign of age, but it's showing that his eyes, in a way, are kind of smiling. He's got the upper lip pull, and he's also showing upper row of visible teeth. It's like, well, that sounds really clinical way to describe a smile. But if you just do a say cheese in front of the camera smile, you usually aren't engaging your full face. So Reagan could kind of do this on command. And what it suggests is that not only is there an emotion being expressed, but there's an intention also being conveyed. So it's not just happiness, but again, it's reassurance. Hey, how's it going? Like, oh, okay, everything's cool. Or it's an anger expression, but the intention is to threaten. Or you've got a fear expression, and your motivation is to get out of there and to evade it. Or you could be sad, and really you're ready just to appease whoever your tormentor might be. Interesting fact, we know from research, reassurance displays discourage aggressive or flight responses. Threat displays strengthen dominant attributions. Both of them promote bonding. Why does Trump go around and rail at everything and continually to kind of spew outrage and threat? Why does he double down at the worst moments on kind of his accusations? Because it works. Now, I don't know if he has a scientific understanding of how it works, but it promotes bonding, and people like it. He uses it at his rallies, and that's his focus group, and it continues to work. Now, you can't see this, but feel free to follow up later. But when we classify displays, it's not just kind of impressionistic or gestalt or holistic or this is what I think it is. It's systematic, and we use categories that have been around for 30, 40 years, and we look at things like what's going on with the eyelids, eyebrows, your eye orientation. Are you looking down? Are you looking up? Your head orientation. Is your head down? Are you kind of off to the side? That's usually a sign of evasion. And what's going on the teeth? The next time you think someone might be angry with you, look to see if their lower teeth are showing. If they are, that's probably not a good sign. Look the next time someone smiles, and suddenly you'll probably see their top row of teeth, and particularly with a spontaneous smile. And you start to look at it this way, and it's hard not to notice certain kind of prototypical displays, right? So here we have happiness, reassurance on the upper left, a neutral expression on the right. Obama, he didn't do this very much, kind of overtly show anger. There's the lower teeth. Also a fixed stare, going back to predators and prey. A fixed stare is very much a signal of threat. And then a little bit of evasion down at the bottom, just wants to be out of that space. Different politicians have different ways of conveying this. As Romney's threat display versus his happiness reassurance display. Some people thought the happiness display was a little bit canned or a little mechanical. It probably wasn't as relaxed as Reagan. Okay, then we get to behavior. Now, all this doesn't happen in snapshot form in real time. It unrolls as kind of fluid behavior. So let's watch what I would classify as an inappropriate display by Obama, and that frankly freaked out a lot of Democrats in the first debate of 2012, creating a lot of Twitter activity. Oop, didn't want to do that.
Down to 25%. But don't forget, you put $90 billion, like 50 years worth of breaks, into solar and wind, to Solyndra and Fisker and Tesla and Enter One. I mean, I had a friend who said, you don't just pick the winners and losers, you pick the losers. All right? So this is not the kind of policy you want to have. You want to get America energy secure.
So it raises the question, who's the president and who's the challenger? And of course, the split screen makes this much harder for the politician and more obvious for the audience. So there was a lot of criticism that got to Obama, and he listened to it. And by the time the third debate came around, he changed his approach. And let's see if we can detect a difference here. So the looking down was thought to be timid, evasive. And you saw at one point he does what's called lip compression, where you kind of blow, like if you close your lips and you blow air towards the bottom of your mouth, like that. That's actually been interpreted by people as muffled anger. He wants to say something but doesn't say it. Okay, third debate, a little bit different.
To help this industry get on its feet. And the idea that has been suggested that I would liquidate the industry, of course not. Of course not.
Let's try that's the height of silliness.
What's that our setup? I would liquidate the industry.
Governor, I want to do
what the floor won't forget it. And that's why.
Okay, not looking down. Looking at the opponent. Fixed stare, but not menacing. Interrupts, doesn't care about the rules of debate. Engages in what we call verbal chicken. There's about five different types of interruptions. So when you interrupt and you continue to talk and the other person continues to talk and you don't know who's going to stop, we call that verbal chicken. And you can have a hostile interruption that's essentially a takeover as well. So if you interrupt and the person who has the floor actually defers to you, then that's considered a hostile takeover. Okay, all this is important. And after the third debate, you know, partisans were a lot more reassured. Okay, then the question is, we've got tools and various techniques of inquiry in research. Well, what happens when we show this to viewers? Now, again, this is going to be hard to see, but I can send a paper out to anybody who'd like it. The question is, are appropriate displays rated more favorably than inappropriate? Does engaging with your opponent, and what I would call Obama's approach in that third debate, was basically visually auditing Romney. He wasn't going to let anything pass, and he was on it the entire time, ready to jump in at a moment's notice. Appropriate displays under the left column here for Obama and Romney. And we've got CRM, which is a continuous response measure. It's the dial. Sometimes it's called the worm, but it's the thing that gives you a squiggly line in real time as a video presentation is going by. The center point is at 50, and you move up from there all the way to 100 if you want. Appropriate displays are rated at 56 on average. Inappropriate displays for Obama at 48. And for Romney, a similar pattern, although they're both above 50, appropriate displays at 66 and inappropriate at 52. This also works on a self-report scale that we also use, like just a 5 or a, I think a 7-point scale. Next question is, we've got an eye tracking device that we use, And here again, people can't always tell you what exactly, what influence exactly nonverbals are having. They don't know what they're staring at or for how long or how many times they keep going back to a certain thing. But if you wear a nice eye-tracking kind of set of glasses, we can tell you what that time is. Appropriate displays. Now, this is consistent with theory. Appropriate displays actually garner fewer fixations and a shorter amount of time. Think about that. We can bring it up in discussion later. But if something's appropriate, you're like, okay, that checks in. I can move on and monitor the other person. All right, appropriate. My part isn't appropriate. Okay, no problem. Inappropriate. Now, wait a minute. We go from a mean duration of fixations on one candidate. It almost doubles when it's inappropriate. Why is that? Because inappropriate displays constitute what we call a nonverbal expectancy violation. What's going on is not expected. It's not in the script. It's not consistent with that person's rank or that person's kind of status or just what you would anticipate happening. And it works consistently across Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. It doesn't matter which partisan is looking. There's something off about what that person's doing based on status. Really interesting stuff. Now, you can take different categories of displays and gestures, as I've been talking about, and you can count them up, and you can look at frequencies and put them into kind of a pastiche of what I call like a nonverbal display repertoire. And you can compare one candidate against the other. You can document in any given time interval, and for the debate overall, which is what this is, how often they're resorting to an anger threat face, a happiness reassurance, a fear, or an evasive expression looking down. You can do that for tone, and then you can do that for gestures. The red bars are Romney. The blue bars are Obama. I've got it for Trump. We're getting to that. Look at the amount of evasion going on Obama relative to Romney in that first debate. Twice as much. That's what accounted for the partisan freakout. Look at the defiance that is going on with Romney. Now, you would expect that of a challenger, but it's not even, you know, approximated by Obama. So in conjunction with the evasion, it's looking pretty sedate, pretty timid. Okay, debate three, what happens to the evasion? It almost goes away for both. There is none. It's just a constant engagement. What happens to defiance? It completely flips. Obama does almost twice as much as Romney. And a defiant gesture is what Trump does a lot. It's a stiff kind of arm. It's a fist. It's punching. It's pointing. It's accusing. He does this thing, which like, like as for the nonverbal, we don't know what that is. But he does it with a scowl, right? So it's defiance. It's like up yours to the establishment, essentially. Okay, these are coded, by the way, at did they occur or not in any 30-second increment. Oh, there we go. Now, when we look at whether attacks work, this is, again, I don't know if Trump's running dial testing, although most political consultants do. You know by executing them that they actually do work. So the blue line, if you can see that at the top, are Republicans rating Trump. The yellow line are Democrats. When Trump is on the attack, that needle moves up. He has this ability to kind of rally partisans. Now, this is a very small N, right? We've got a continuous response theater. It seats 34. We had it maxed out. That's all the dials we have. This isn't large scale. But it replicates other findings that we've seen. Okay, a little bit of a lag, but you see, Democrats don't like it. They realize, oh, he's on the attack. Republicans are up there, you know, close to 75. Now, another thing that's really interesting about this, if you look at the, we took a dial test measures across both the first and third debate. Trump gets into the 90s. There's one point at which his partisan line basically goes off the top end. We've never seen that before. And Clinton's maxes out around 70. It's the highest he ever gets. So you're mobilizing partisans, but who's mobilizing more? And we call that kind of the enthusiasm gap. And that's one thing that Trump's able to do. All right, let's go to populism and get to Trump proper. And populism has been described by a lot of authors who have a much kind of deeper and sociological and historical understanding of it. But I'm looking at it from a communication point of view. And back to the idea of a communication logic, and looking not just at what the arguments are against others, against established elites, against the system they're going to accuse of being corrupt, and on issues like immigration or law and order. I'm looking at it from a nonverbal perspective and asking, can we come up with a set of indicators that would almost be a populist index? You turn the sound off, can we know if somebody is essentially a populist by what they're doing and how they're doing it and how consistently they're doing it? And I think we can. But let me show you how I got to there. So first of all, we look at key stylistic features from the literature. Populism, includes a lot of drama, polarization, moralizing, ostracism, directness, mass appeal, and vulgarity. But the core elements, as kind of identified by Engesser and co-authors, are really useful. It involves simplification, emotionalization of issues and divisions in society, and negativity, relentless negativity, starting to sound like Trump. Okay, now, can we map this on to a kind of nonverbal paradigm and look at it in the context of debate dynamics? Now, I did a comparison once of looking at Obama's communication in 2012, comparing it with Nixon's first debate performance in 1960. And there were actually some similarities. Nixon had certain signs of stress or certain things that didn't quite fit the context. Obama had a similar thing. Nixon was evidencing signs of defeat. Of course, he went into that debate after a hospitalization. A lot of people don't know that. That's why he was sweating and doing other things. But he had more furtive glances. He tended to look down more. Kennedy was more direct and engaged. But there's an interesting kind of parallel. So I thought, well, maybe we can take this approach to Trump in 2016. So what would simplification consist of? It would be displays that are easy to understand. They're not nuanced. They're not, if you're a Star Trek fan, kind of the raise of an eyebrow, or kind of the twitch of an ear. It's much more obvious and clear than that. It's emotionalized communication. Whether it's an anger display, a defiance gesture, tone of voice, which raises, and which also is a paravocal cue. You don't have to understand the language and the semantic meaning of a word if somebody is communicating a hostile or friendly tone that's usually understood without knowledge of the language. Interruptions might be another form of emotionalization in that they represent impatience, and then inappropriate displays. Negativity would be kind of each of these categories if they're going in an attack or in a negative, aggressive kind of dimension or direction. All right, so I'm not going to go over these, but these are just some of the variables that we're working with. Anger, threat, defiance, nonverbal disagreement, even a visual interruption, trying to get the moderator's attention or just dismissing. Actually, Clinton did one thing. She did this going all the way back to debates with Bernie Sanders, and she would go like this, the wave off. Wherever the opponent was, she would look straight ahead and wave off the opponent. It's like kind of a Marie Antoinette move, just off with you. You don't need to be on the same stage with me. So she did a little bit. It was much more muted. Hostile interruptions, verbal non-fluencies. Does the candidate get the whole phrase out, the whole soundbite, or their incomplete sentences, mispronunciation, non sequiturs, etc. Character attacks might be a verbal sign of populism. Of course, the angry tone. Sophistication you can measure using text parsers. How many six-letter words are there or more? Believe it or not, there weren't statistical differences between Trump and Clinton on the use of over six-letter words. Of course, that's not a high threshold, right? The use of I, they language and also blame. Okay, Trump is in the red. He does a lot more of everything. A lot, you know, almost all the time. Now, in 2016, we thankfully had some really dedicated graduate students, and we were able to code this at 10-second intervals. Does a given behavior happen, yes or no, is it present or absent, within a given 10-second increment across 90 minutes of the debate? You get an N, you get over 500 individual increments. What happens in the third debate? Well, Clinton picks up a little more anger and threat, but Trump continues to outdo her. I'm getting short on time here, so try to cut to the chase. And then if we look at Clinton compared to herself, debate one to debate three, she starts to engage in a little more personal attack, and she ups her game, but look at the numbers. The numbers are, you know, pretty small. So these are percentages out of 533. Now we look at Trump's percentages, and you're into the 40s, the 60s, 60%. And if you add these up, is he doing at least one of these every 10 seconds? The answer is pretty much yes. Then we normed it back to 2012, and we collapsed it down to 30-second increments, and we compared Trump to Romney and Obama. We thought, well, maybe it's just a gender effect, and there were certain stereotypes at play that kind of inhibited Hillary from aggressing. So let's compare it mano and mano. Trump dominates. If Trump was there in the third debate, in 2012, he's just doing way more, again, of everything. He's in the red. That's debate one. And then his debate three performance, again, just eclipses what Obama and Romney are doing. Now, that's a pretty crude measure, but it gives you some comparative idea. Okay, so Trump's style was to aggress. Clinton's style was to wait it out. Trump's display repertoire is going to be described as kind of a melange of anger, threat, aggression, and defiance, punctuated by interruptions and protestations. Exactly what you want to be up against in a debate. No, not really. But it's betrayed a little bit by signs of stress. If you really watch this thing, and if you heard in that one clip, he's kind of sniffing. Well, you know, I have an answer to that. And no, I didn't sniff at all, which he denied the next day. And people were asking, why did you sniff? Well, if you look that up, most nonverbal tics have an explanation. He's literally kind of trying to get more oxygen into his system because he's a little bit nervous. He does a lot of fidgeting. He grips the podium. He almost uses it as a steadier. And there was an enormous amount of water he was using in both debates. So he attempted to modulate some of this with his voice early on, coming in a little bit quieter, a little bit softer. By the end of both debates, he's just absolutely almost shouting. So we studied this and kind of concluded that really he's an inappropriate aggressor, but that's different from an illegal aggressor. See, you can call somebody out on norm violations, but if there aren't any real hard, fast rules at play, you can interrupt and you can aggress and you can be angry and you can throw out character attacks. If you're playing the old game, you can have a softer, more diplomatic, even more lawyerly approach. You can wait it out for your turn. You can finally hit them with your shot when it's your turn to make an argument. But that places you more beholden to the rules and to establishment politics more generally. And as I'm going to show real fast here, it isn't a strategy that sustains viewer attention. So it may abide by the rules, but we're in, particularly in the U.S., a hyper-commercialized, 24/7 mediated media environment, obviously. But it's on you all the time to try to get the viewer's attention. And we're in a hybrid media system where we've got online and networked and traditional broadcasting all going on at the same time. How do you maintain attention in this complex, fragmented media space? Trump does it by making himself the show, the spectacle, and interrupting visually. In the second debate, we didn't code this systematically, but I did some focus groups on it. And focus groups noticed that. Everybody noticed that. That was a big topic of conversation afterwards. Why does he keep invading your space? Of course, Alec Baldwin does a great send-up of it on Saturday Night Live, kind of the Trump shark, right? But this is what Clinton wrote about and what she said about it in her book. She says, this is not okay. It was the second presidential debate, and Donald Trump was looming behind me 2 days before. The world heard him brag about groping women. Now we were on a small stage, and no matter where I walked, he followed me closely, staring at me, making faces. It was incredibly uncomfortable. He was literally breathing down my neck. My skin crawled. So, you know, again, kind of Democratic freak out. Why didn't she turn around and say, get away from me, you creep? But she didn't. Instead, what she writes after this paragraph is, I felt like turning to the audience and taking a poll. Do you want me to confront him or not? Why do you need a poll? Like, maybe just show some leadership? I don't know. Okay, so what are some themes here that focus group observers notice? They're pretty bothered by it, at least in West Texas. So physicality as an attempt to interrupt, steal attention, and intimidate doesn't really go over well. He hovered over her the whole time. It was a bullying tactic. And it was distracting, which, of course, that is the strategy there, right? So if everybody's looking at him and wondering what's he doing, because it's a nonverbal expectancies violation, they're not looking at her, even though it's her speaking turn. He's basically stealing her words right away from her. So the debate can be going on, but everybody's processing what's happening with Trump. Here's one student who commented, Trump sends so many messed up signals, it's very confusing to watch. Like, I have a hard time reading him as a person. Okay? It's a kind of confusion, but attention, right? You're trying to figure out what's going on there. I don't quite understand. And it scares me. Admittedly, Clinton isn't the most personable politician either. All right, I'm going to race through, because I'm out of time, some of the Twitter response to this. But basically what we did was we took the debate in real time, and we knew where we were with the coding because we coded it in 10-second increments. And we lined it up, we synchronized it with Twitter responses, and then we used the nonverbal communication and a populism index to figure out what's driving Twitter responses during the debates. The top kind of arc is the volume of tweets that mention Donald Trump. You can see there at any given point they are above 6,000. This is mass numbers of people tweeting about Trump. At Clinton, again, we have the enthusiasm gap. On average, she's probably around mid-2000s. Trump is getting literally three times the response she is on Twitter. Now, I know this is going to look confusing, but just look at the yellow highlighted cells. And this represents our visual populism index. And the times are, T6 means you're out at 60-second lag. So how long does it take for a tweet to reflect back on what was said during the debate? You know, when we use time sinks. And if you're looking at effects of visuals, it happens not only the quickest within 10 seconds, it also happens at 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 and 60. It's an argument for nonverbal influence. People wouldn't say they're moved by it, but when you model it carefully and when you code all this behavior and you put it to a test, it actually does seem to work. Now, this is Trump, so his verbals aren't really helping him until about 40 seconds out. But if we look at Clinton, there's an interesting kind of parallel in terms of the verbal. First of all, her visuals aren't popping as pronounced. The coefficients are smaller. That's the top yellow bar. And then the bottom yellow bar, her verbals really don't start kicking in until about 30 seconds out. And again, the coefficients, at least at 30 seconds, a little bit smaller than Trump's visual coefficients. But then she starts to get traction, particularly at 40 and 50 seconds. Now, what's happening before 40 and 50 seconds? Trump has got attention and Twitter response at 10 seconds, at 20 seconds, at 30 seconds, at 40 seconds. Oh, Clinton pops up. Now she's getting some traction. This is the problem of waiting your turn and waiting it out, is that the populist style and the way human attention works, it's going to grab the mass audience, and it's going to really kind of interrupt and upset the flow of kind of natural, polite debate. So, getting a little bit depressed by some of these findings, like really, that's kind of what it's about. This is what people like, or at least what they respond to. So I had a survey go into the field about a week and a half ago, and I asked people, what communication style do you prefer? And I had people name their top three choices out of a list of about 10 things. Here's what emerges by party. Democrats are blue, Republicans are red, Independents are gray. Standing up for the people emerges as pretty much the top item, followed by a clear vision for the country. An outlook that involves compromise is popular, particularly among independents in the middle there. An aggressive temperament on the bottom and a view of politics as a winner-takes-all struggle are the least endorsed, although slightly more endorsed by Republicans, which is interesting. And then I looked at it in terms of ideology, and what you see is that people identify themselves in the center of the spectrum. They appreciate experience, again, standing up for people's interests, an outlook that involves compromise, and a calm and collected style. So maybe this is kind of unique to Trump and not necessarily what people want. So looking to next Tuesday and kind of getting out of this presentation, there's a phenomenon happening in Texas, and it's a three-term congressman and former mayor of El Paso who's challenging incumbent Senator Ted Cruz for Senate, which is a statewide office, which is a launching point for a lot of national candidates. So Beto O'Rourke has visited all 200-plus counties in Texas, many of them more than once. Mine is in that upper left quadrant. It's kind of right below the kind of the panhandle there where Oklahoma comes in. It's the middle of nowhere. He's been there five or six times. The other day he was there, this is 2 days ago, there was an overflow of 300 people when he spoke in Lubbock, my friend writes. He wrote me this today. He went outside and spoke for another 15 minutes to those who couldn't enter. My neighbor sends me the sign, Republicans for Beto. Now, is that going back to that desire for a calmer, more reasoned kind of politics, which is a little bit of what Beto represents? Or is it that people are just suddenly tired of Ted Cruz? Trump's come out very much aligned with Cruz in this particular election. All right, so takeaways and then I'm done. Along with its grievances and resentments, populism can be seen, I think, to some extent as a nonverbal communication phenomenon. Responses to populism's performance can be observed in second screen activity at real-time events. It would be very interesting to do this in other national contexts. Brazil just elected a populist. Populists are on the rise. Different countries in Europe and increasingly worldwide. The Twitter using public seems reactive to aggressive debate behavior. Does this correlate and reflect voting intentions? We're going to see within a week. Responses to nonverbals are significant at every lag time, whereas arguments and rhetorical tactics take longer to kind of draw a response. I think that gives advantage to nonverbal communicators. And in the face of populist attacks, I think waiting only lessens your resonance and your effectiveness. So the question is, well, what do you do? How do you respond to this? Do you just get in the mud and start shouting? Not quite. I think we look to France for an interesting response. And if you look at some of the debates between Macron and Le Pen, there's kind of a path forward that involves politeness but assertiveness, almost like Obama in that third debate in 2012. One final clip.
Madame Le Pen, vous serez gentille.
Je ne vous fais pas. Vous avez déclaré, non ?
Je ne vous fais pas parler. Je n'ai pas besoin d'aventriloque. Je vous assure, tout va très bien. Quand j'ai quelque chose à dire, je le dis clairement, c'est mon habitude.
Alors que pensez-vous du burkini,
monsieur ? Je l'ai dit très clairement, ça n'a rien à voir avec la laïcité parce que ça n'est pas culturel. C'est un sujet d'ordre public. Donc le burkini, je suis pour éviter, comme d'ailleurs le piège nous est tendu par celles et ceux qui veulent diviser la société, d'en faire un grand débat de laïcité. Le piège dans lequel lequel vous êtes en train de tomber, Madame Le Pen, par vos provocations, c'est de diviser la société, c'est de faire que les plus de 4 millions de Françaises et de Français, dont la religion et l'islam, et qui sont pour la très grande majorité, absolument pas dans le communautarisme, mais qui vivent dans notre République, c'est d'en faire des ennemis de la République. Eh bien, moi, non.
Just once, can we see that in the U.S.? All right, so here's kind of a cheeky thing to end on, but I do think it's coming up as a phenomenon. And that is the way a lot of these things just kind of don't make a lot of sense, I think is akin to the verbal form of this, which is bullshit, but now it's visual bullshit. But it's still providing social information, so it's still communicating dominance, and if that's the goal, it somehow works. Even if the gestures, expressions, and non-fluencies don't add up or fit, that's not the point. The point is, I'm going to try to dominate this stage and kind of roll over you. So visual BS is short on words, but long on disruptive theatrics. But I think understanding its resonance, large-scale data, smaller-scale, more precise precision measurements, is key to kind of countering its outsized influence. So with that, I'd say we basically just need to roll up our sleeves and see what happens. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Eric, and thank you, everyone. And I've never been so uncomfortably aware of my own facial gestures and body language at this point. One of the things I really want to pick up on is this question of whether what Trump does is actually replicable, whether it can be repeated by anybody else, or whether Trump and the success that Trump has enjoyed is basically a sui generis thing that actually can't be repeated. One of the words that's often used to describe Trump that features in this paper is populist. I think that we're learning that even though populism does actually these days have quite a clear meaning, and it's a political orientation that sees the central conflict of politics as being between the people and the elites, the sort of pure people and the corrupt elites, there are many, many different versions of this. And I think that the first thing to note about Trump is that he embodies a particularly kind of American version of this. His authority comes from his supposed mastery of businesses, which have always been kind of borderline illegal, around real estate development and casinos. And so he comes across as somebody who operates in these worlds where you have to break the rules in order to succeed. And Trump's whole shtick is basically his instinct, his decision-making, his disregard for the rules, and his willingness to take charge of everything is what enables him to succeed in an incredibly cruel system. The absurdity that Trump is a highly successful businessman in the United States, it's one of these things that sort of highlights the cruelty and arbitrariness of the system, but also it says to people, look, Trump is somebody who can do it. And Trump has, you know, for many years essentially sold his secrets. All of his books were about this is how you can do it as well, while at the same time preserving his own mystique of really I am the only one who can do this. If you remember, one of his election slogans was I alone can fix this, which is something you wouldn't normally necessarily expect of a populist. Populists are all about identifying with the people. Trump, in fact, constantly places himself above the people. If you were to look at populism purely sort of verbally, you wouldn't say Trump is a populist at all. Trump, among other things, constantly touts his Ivy League educational background. When you look at his judicial appointments and the people he endorses in Congress, he is absolutely obsessed with Harvard and Yale. Here he is talking about Ron DeSantis. In Florida, there's a choice between a Harvard-Yale-educated man named Ron DeSantis, who's been a great congressman and will be a great governor, and a Dem who is a thief and who is mayor of poorly run Tallahassee. Now, in your classical sort of populist calculus, you'd want the small-town mayor, not the Harvard-Yale-educated guy. This does not bother Trump. Trump in June had a rally where he had this verbal end run completely around the whole populist dichotomy of elites and people. He said, I hate it. I meet these people. They call it the elite. We got more money. We got more brains. We got better houses and apartments. We got nicer boats. We're smarter than they are. And they say they're the elite. Let's call ourselves from now on the super elite. So he is completely outside of that conceptual verbal world of populism where you're identifying with the people against the elites. What he's actually demanding is essentially to be recognised as the uber elite, as the most, the most kind of dominant primate out there. And this gets us to the point of, is Trump's style actually replicable even within the United States? I've got my doubts that it is. We saw people attempting it all the time during the Republican primaries. Once it became clear the extent to which Trump was winning the debates for all of the reasons that Eric was talking about. I remember seeing those early debates and you would see Republican analysts on afterwards saying, oh, well, you know, Rubio clearly had the best performance and Chris Christie made that great point about Israel. And it reminded me of Roger Ailes, the deceased Fox News chairman, who could be a student of Eric's in terms of his analysis of TV. He said, if you want to know whether a presenter is good or bad, watch them with the sound off. And if you were watching Republican primary debates with the sound off, exactly what Eric was talking about. You had Trump standing in the middle of the stage, everybody else's attention constantly on him. It did not matter what was actually being said in these debates. I think that we have to take into account the sheer difference of Trump's personal background coming into politics. So Trump, it's not surprising, Trump understood the theatrics of television so much better than everybody both in the Republican race and better than all of the political strategists. Now, Trump made this very interesting decision halfway through the campaign that he wouldn't spend a huge amount of money on TV advertising. I was initially very cynical about this. I thought, it's because he doesn't own any TV stations. But actually, it turned out to be a very clever decision. He knows how TV works, and he actually knows that political advertising is a lousy thing when translated into TV. Now, of course, he's not the first politician with this kind of background, as Eric mentioned. You had Ronald Reagan with this acting background. But look at what Ronald Reagan was able to do with that acting background. It was all about sort of self-control and control of the body, the ability to produce that smile on command. Trump has nothing like that kind of control. He would not be able to master his body in the same way. To look at a more local example, Margaret Thatcher became aware at some point that her accent wasn't sufficiently up to scratch for the highest levels of British politics. So on the advice of Laurence Olivier, she had acting training. Once again, that was actually about bringing herself under control. It was about mastering the anger that often came across on her face and also about completely changing her accent. Now, Trump doesn't come from an acting background. Trump's background is reality TV. I mean, even though reality TV is a form of acting, it was far much more like he was just given free rein by NBC to essentially be himself. And also, in that format, it wasn't about controlling himself at all, it was about controlling other people. You know, Trump may have the natural talents of a school bully, but I'm convinced that he actually mastered all of those dominance gestures and how they would actually play out on camera while he was on NBC and while he was doing The Apprentice. And I think it's going to be very hard for someone without that kind of background, without essentially a lifetime of practice of this stuff, to be able to replicate it. I just want to make a couple of quick points about what Eric was talking about, sort of looking at this on a cross-national basis. I believe that populist style varies hugely across cross-national contexts, even relatively similar ones. If you look at someone who's often identified as a populist in this country, Boris Johnson, okay, if you ever see Boris Johnson on TV, his hair is always messed up. This is not by coincidence. Okay, he is known to carry a comb around with him to mess up his hair at any opportunity. And that's because he's playing into a particularly kind of British conservative populist stereotype, which is like, I'm the jolly old aristocrat of days gone by who isn't allowed to exist anymore because we don't have any fun in this country anymore. ever since it's been ruled by European bureaucrats and social workers. Boris Johnson is a sort of self-conscious throwback to the wealthy British eccentric. You compare this to Trump's hair, right? You know, Trump basically never allows his hair to be seen as anything less than what he would consider perfect. You might not consider it perfect, but, you know, this is what he considers good. I also just want to make a sort of broader conceptual point about cross-national populism, which is in both the US and the UK, populism, I believe, depends on a sense of national loss. In the US, there's very much a consciousness that, you know, we used to be the undisputed great power within our own lifetimes. We don't have that anymore. This is something that Trump has, a feeling that Trump has just exploited endlessly. You know, we're being pushed around by other countries. In Britain as well, there's also a sense of loss, what Paul Gilroy called post-imperial melancholia, about the loss of empire, which is something that often feeds into immigration debates here. To go to my own country of Australia, well, the slogan, make Australia great again, just wouldn't work, okay, because we never really thought we were that great. The most successful populist slogan in my lifetime, which was by John Howard, who was something like 10 prime ministers ago now, 10 years ago. When he was asked what his vision for the country was, it was for everyone to be relaxed and comfortable. You know, that's as dramatic as populism gets in Australia. And so just to end on that note, I'm not convinced that Trump is replicable even within the US, let alone outside it. And I think that one of the things that this tells us about populism is that it's sort of infinitely adaptable to a lot of different circumstances. Thank you.
All right. So I'm conscious of the time ticking away, and I'm sure that there are questions from the audience. But I can't help just add one little anecdote about Ronald Reagan. Which probably reflects my age, but I was a young voter coming into sort of political life at the time of the 1980 election, and I was not a supporter of Ronald Reagan. I was a rebel, you know, independent voter. But I came to endorse Ronald Reagan, and I've thought about, in a Trump era, why Reagan acquired this sort of aura of being the Teflon presidency. Partly, yes, it was a lot of this nonverbal and the times and so on, but there was an added component to Ronald Reagan that clearly differentiates him from Trump, and that Reagan made Americans feel happy to be Americans again. We'd come out of Watergate, from the Vietnam War, from this sort of imperial presidency and then the debacle of the Carter presidency and the Iran hostage situation and then the failed attempt to rescue the hostages. And we felt pretty crappy as Americans. And Reagan said, you know what, you can be proud. You can. And he did it in a warm-hearted way, in a way that told a lot of jokes. You could feel books with the jokes that Ronald Reagan told. And that's a totally different style to Trump's very aggressive, very hostile style. Part of that is nonverbal, but part of it is also verbal. Anyway, that's what I just had to say. Okay, so never mind. Questions from the audience. I'm sure we'll have lots. So why don't we take them in threes, and we'll see how many we can get through. And we have people coming around with mics, so just wait for the mic. So we've got one, two, and up the checkered shirt. Yeah, it's one, two, three.
A fascinating lecture. I'm autistic. As autistic, I try to study methods to cope with that. One of the things that these candidates are doing is paltering, which is telling the truth, only the truth, but not all the truth. They include subordinate clauses that make their body language agree with the partial truth that they are saying. And this is something that Trump has mastered, bullying people during negotiations, during private negotiations. So it's not just what he did in public, it's also what he did in private. And I wonder if anybody has studied, you know, like Ekman facial analysis coding system, figure out what he's doing when he's telling partial truths, which is most of the time.
Hmm. Second, in the pink shirt, yeah, the pink shirt.
What did the challenge, the point around this not being reproducible? So there's various media reports that say the strong man of Europe and the world are trying to copy Trump's approach. So you've got Ataturk in Turkey, you've got the Philippines president. There's this, I guess, mindset of them versus us, almost like siege mentality that seems to be growing and developing. And I see that as almost something that's quite common in a number of industries, almost in football, for example. If you see, I guess, someone like Arsene Wenger or Mourinho, he's always blaming someone else and deflecting the problem. What's your views on that?
Hi, my name is Bill. I'm a graduate student here in the government department, and I wanted to ask you if you could speak a little bit more to the implicit role of gender in your theory. So how do you see your theory of nonverbal political communication playing out across gendered lines, given that politicians who identify as women, especially in the United States, oftentimes face a clear double bind? So if Clinton is too soft, or she's too diplomatic, or she's too lawyerly, or as you put it, she should have just shown some leadership, then she's seen as weak. But on the flip side, if she's too aggressive or too defiant, then she's seen as a bitch, pardon my French. And then the deeper question, I guess, implicit is that given the kind of inherent instability in defining these categories, how do you make sure you have a reliable theory of nonverbal political communication or even a reliable science of it? Thanks.
All right. Feel free to chime in, David. But on the first point, do we know exactly what Trump's expressions look like in relation to all his statements? No, we don't. And it's hard to keep up with. But there's a really interesting kind of trend/breakthrough that's just about to happen in nonverbal communication. If anybody's interested, this is a really interesting time to get into it, which is computer vision is now is on the verge of being able to track large quantities of visual information from video that we've never had before. Previous generations of software, for instance, if you put on a debate video and you turn your face 30 degrees, doesn't recognize that it's a face anymore. But I've got another paper out with a computer scientist we have to work with on this stuff. And we're modeling a lot of these behaviors just in the context of the debate, because you have to validate it with human coding, which is another problem, right? How do you get to a large corpus? But once we can train the classifier, then the goal is to look at a lot of different press conferences, a massive set of data, and then really pinpoint what's going on. And then it won't seem like maybe such a genius tactic. Maybe it'll seem like, oh, is that all it is? But it's so consistent and so repetitive. So we're on the verge of that. The second question about the siege mentality, yeah, I've reflected on this. And, you know, in addition to us being in kind of a mediated world, we're also in a very emotional world now. And, you know, people are starting to talk about network media in terms of kind of the emotionality that it enables and the flows. Well, one of the things that populists, and Trump in particular, but all populists kind of leverage is fear. Now, that's not new in politics, but they leverage it in a way that's very persistent and overwhelming. And it's fear of the other. So in the U.S. right now, there's kind of a campaign by a television network and some, conspiracy websites to paint the migrant caravan that's coming up towards the U.S. as a hostile threat. Well, these people are going to basically surrender themselves to authorities, and we don't need to send down 14,000 troops. So it's an incredible waste of money. But there's a stoking of that fear. And so I was listening to the BBC this morning, and they interviewed, a typical American voter. And the talking point is that, well, those migrants, for instance, really represent kind of a threat. And what are they up to? And they're going to crash our borders. And we need strong kind of control. And I'm thinking, well, I know exactly what news media is paying attention to. But the problem is, to some extent, even though we respond to it, we're becoming too emotional in our politics. And I do think we need to become a little more thoughtful and less reactive and more calm. So I was happy to see in the survey that people are asking about that. The third question was about gender in a theory of gender and nonverbals. This is a really understudied aspect of kind of visual communication, but there is some pretty decent work on gender stereotypes and the different kind of double standard that seems to apply to male and female candidates. I do think it is applicable to nonverbal communication. And I would love to interview Hillary Clinton as to what advice she got about how she should approach this, because I guarantee it was discussed. But I think in the face of populists who don't care about tradition and norms and establishment and polite kind of discourse, I think you have to abandon some of that and just confront them almost Macron style and just take them head on, because they may very easily back down, but they won't if you don't go there. So I'm not saying we have to go low if they go low, but we have to at least meet them and neutralize them.
Can I just add to that? I think in addition to gender, you really have to consider race in this as well. The constraints that Obama operated under his entire presidency, because as an African American, you couldn't be seen as too angry, I think are really important. Also, just in response to the second question, I think I'm agreeing with you in the sense that you shouldn't just analogize, you know, Bolsonaro, oh, he's the Brazilian Trump. I'm seeing some absurd things where they're talking about leaders who arose before Trump, like Duterte in the Philippines saying, oh, he's the Filipino Trump. You know, a lot of different national circumstances have produced right-wing populists, left-wing populists in some cases, and they're not all just imitations of Trump. On the football point, I think it's politics catching up with football rather than the other way around. In fact, if anything, football's actually getting a little bit less aggressive. I went to Millwall on Saturday expecting to see some violence. Didn't see any. I was very disappointed.
All right. Further questions? So, these three. Try one, two, and three.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. And when listening to your presentation, I was kind of feeling that as an advice to politicians, if you want to win, you should be populist somehow, like because your studies showed that people react to that more, that people like it somehow. So my question would be, first of all, is that true? And secondly, how can you encounter that? Like, how can you, as a normal politician, try to encounter a populist if somebody runs against you? Very simple question, but probably very hard to answer.
The lady at the end. The lady. Okay.
Hi, my name's Steph and I'm a graduate war studies student at King's College. I was wondering if, as far as possible, if you take away Trump's personal reputation and his policies, do you think that Trump's body language and nonverbal behavior affect U.S. diplomatic relationships with other states to the point where the West would actually be more at risk of going into conflict? Thank you.
And one more in the center.
Hi, I'm Marco. I'm an undergraduate history student here at LSE. My question just addresses kind of like the question presented in the title, which I don't think really has been touched on, but is it like, will this fascination like survive the midterms? And I don't really expect you to have a solid answer as much as like, where do you see the trends going? Like, is there progressively like, are certain sides just getting more into like a bubble of living in this type of like fascination with this style, or are we breaking free finally from this sort of like inundation of whatever Trump style truly is?
Yeah, I think let's start with the third question. So we at least address the point, and I want to hear what David has to say about this as well. But I think in the U.S., I tend to agree with David that this is hard to replicate, that there is a unique set of circumstances that led Trump to kind of occupy the space. And most people, if they double down on it, they would be long gone and forgotten already. So I don't really see it emerging organically in the U.S. Now, the problem is we have such a hyper-commercialized media system. If somebody else can do something similar just to attract attention, the networks and the media system hasn't shown any restraint or any ability to kind of not pay attention to it, not cover it, not get more viewers and subscribers even, and therefore make money off it. So I think we're kind of in a bind there. But so assuming the Democrats win the House, which polls seem to be indicating, the Senate up for grabs, we'll just have to see what happens. I think we get the first kind of real pushback against Trumpism and Trump's style, and we'll start to get a more robust debate, and I think some harsher or some more norm enforcement, let's say. But that doesn't mean that the influence of Trump's style internationally will subside. So I see a lot of opportunism in other countries and would-be dictators that are kind of using the Trump example, you know, to be hardliners in their country.
So there are three possible outcomes with the midterm, and from the point of view of polarization and governability in the United States, none of them are good. It's either going to be some form of divided government or the same unified government that that we've seen for the last 2 years, which remarkably has been able to do very little. In defense of the sort of media focus on Trump's style, you know, you often hear, why isn't the media focusing more on the issues that matter to people? Why aren't they focusing on policy issues? It's a little bit hard when there's no actual policy happening. And it's the most likely outcome, which is that Democrats take the House and Republicans keep control of the Senate, means that there's going to be even less happening. The sort of gridlock that has been a feature not just of the last 2 years, but really of the last 10, is going to continue. And under those circumstances, the style becomes the substance of politics. And even in the area of foreign policy, to get to the second question, which is the area over which Trump has the most latitude, it's the stylistic elements of it that have dominated. You know, presidents traditionally are very, very sparing in terms of the statements that they make about foreign policy. They don't want to give away too much of what the United States is doing, of what the machinery of state is thinking. Trump's the exact opposite. It's sort of, there's this constant sort of almost stream of consciousness going on, to the extent that the tweets actually become the substance of foreign policy. The things we usually think of as the substance of foreign policy, things like the US-North Korea agreement, for example, there's nothing to that agreement. It's a kind of statement of intent. What the policy is the statements, all of the statements around it from both leaders. So as much as we may want to sort of break the fascination of the style, at the moment, the style and the substance of politics are really hard to separate from each other.
Yeah, just on the second point, I would say at first I was really concerned about Trump kind of bumbling into some armed conflict with another country. Increasingly, I see it a little bit differently. I think he's what his instinct is just to undo what came before him, and then use that as kind of in a populist sense to say, well, we're going to give voice back to the people, or, you know, we're going to negotiate it better, almost in an apprentice style. So he doesn't seem to be kind of creating foreign policy as much as just undoing it, along with a lot of trade agreements, to give the impression that he's doing something. And what I've observed is that he's really out of sorts and out of his element when he travels abroad. And he meets a lot of resistance, and he sees it on the street. And there's no way to slough that off as, you know, bias network coverage or as, you know, a few partisans that don't like him at home. I mean, there was massive protests when he came over here, and they kept him away from the center of activity, which is highly unusual. And frankly, when he went to North Korea, in a way, he got played a little bit by Kim Jong-un. He ended up unwittingly in a propaganda video where he's saluting a North Korean general and looking like he just doesn't know how to do that. So the Chinese, I think, were really concerned about him early on, and then they would send back-channel communications. Would somebody responsible in the administration please reach out to us and so we can actually have a policy? And for a while, I thought they were the most effective critics of Trump. It's kind of an interesting turn of events. So finally, back to the first question. Would I advise other candidates to kind of embrace a populist style? You know, I don't like to see it myself. If you're a consultant, you want, you know, your client to win, right? I think, you show the data, but there's a break on this, almost a natural break, which goes back to David's point, which is not everybody can pull this off. So I did some local TV news consulting and still do that once in a while. And you have what's called recruiters in the TV news business. And these are people who are on their way up in terms of ratings and in terms of dynamism on air. And they have the ability to kind of draw in new audiences or convert people who are used to watching other stations into watching your station. It's a very rare talent. So to have somebody don a populist suit who isn't at all comfortable would be like putting Al Gore in a cowboy hat in shirt sleeves standing up in the middle of Texas in the back of a pickup truck. He tried to do that, and boy, did it look awkward. Obama really never came out of his suit, and that was probably for the best.
Yeah, I think that, and also looking at Trump's success, obviously we have to bear in mind, not only did he get fewer votes than Hillary Clinton, he also got a lower percentage of the vote than Mitt Romney got in 2012. So populism isn't a sort of magic bullet. I think one of the important, really important dynamics was to look at the places where Trump won, counties which Obama had won twice, sometimes by double digits, and now Trump was winning them by double digits. They didn't suddenly turn against Obama. Obama was still really popular in these places. Both candidates, by very different routes, got to the same point with electors in the upper Midwest, which is telling them, hey, government can actually do something for you. Now, I mean, very, very different messages. You know, Obama, yes, we can. Trump, build the wall. But build the wall is sort of like a right-wing version of yes, we can. It was, you know, it was an expression of confidence in the government can actually do something about your concerns. And given that most people are not, you know, don't have a lot of time for ideological coherence, yeah, that worked. But it doesn't mean that populism is always going to be the way.
Okay, I know that we're running out of time, but if we're really quick, I think we could squeeze in one more quick round. I think there was someone who had a question over here, the check. Is anyone really dying? So I'll take two more and then be succinct in our replies. So one over here, in the sort of blue-gray shirt and in the orange-red shirt here. Okay.
My question, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we can fit the gentleman in the front. Okay, so all three ones in the middle here. So we've got, yep.
Hello, I'm Daniel. I'm a student here. My question is, Donald Trump has had numerous political positions. He ran as a candidate for the Reform Party in 2000, and he was affiliated with the Democrat Party for a time after that. My question is, would his style, has any research been conducted on what his style was like at these various points? And if not, do you think there would be a marked difference between the different political positions.
Okay. Right, the red shirt.
Hi, my name is Mark, and my question was related to, so Steve Bannon recently in an interview, he said that Trump was just the vehicle for his ideas, that they try to get other people, such as Sarah Palin first, but they didn't want to. And he actually said we wanted to get trade and immigration from number 50 to number 1 and number 2 as the issues. So my question is, would they have achieved getting the ideology there without Trump and without his performance? So without the vehicle, would they have triumphed?
Okay, and one last question here in the front.
Hi there, thank you. Just to squeeze this in really quickly. My question is, I go back to the question you asked, which is around the headline, will the American fascination with Trump style last? So it seems to me that the intensity of dysfunction, be it, you know, you call it a partisan dysfunction, call it whatever you want to call it, media dysfunction, a reality dysfunction, is getting more and more and more intense. And the slide you put up about what do good meaning, you know, when you ask people in the calm of a one-on-one environment, what do you prefer? And you talk to independents, you talk to Republicans, mm-hmm. Democrats, whatever you want to call them, they pick things that are quite normal, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. you and I would pick, mm-hmm. right? So you've got to say when you have a dynamic of increasing dysfunction and a sort of a stable, this is normal, that actually the gap between the two is getting bigger. So back to that headline question, at what point, you're studying this a lot, you're looking at it very closely, we've measured it with behavioral and non-verbal cues and, verbal stuff. At what point does it break? What's your sense? This is a speculative question.
Mm. So if we can keep replies fairly quick. So.
All right, I'll go through them quick. What was Trump's style in the early days? Well, so I grew up in L.A. and, did a little bit of business journalism, and everybody kind of encountered Donald Trump either on television or in, his face in the bookstore or just in the news magazines. And he actually had a much different aura back in the day, and he was seen as kind of the almost elegant kind of a sophisticated playboy, and he looked like a guy for at some stage, probably in his late 20s through his 30s, maybe into his 40s, that he wouldn't mind sitting down and kind of, hearing his views about different issues and how he kind of views business. At some point, all that turned, and he became a really hot reality show mess. So I wish he had, if he was that intent on going into politics, I wish he had done it younger, because I think the younger Donald Trump had more sense about him. I wonder, and other people do, whether he's a little too old and doesn't realize some of the things that he's saying or the effect it'll have, or he does, and he's really just, he could care less about it. So I would rather know the younger Trump. Let's see, on the third point, I'm going to jump to the third point. Will Trump style last? And how much can the system take? I don't think another 4 years after these next 2 years is going to be good for the country, particularly if the institutions of government continue to have mass departures and we don't restaff at a high level of competence. You can kind of tear things apart and you can kind of cruise on reputation for so long, but at a certain point, it's just going to stop working. I've been shocked myself just how quickly it could seem to fall apart. I think we still have all the talent. It's just a matter of assembling it. And we can right the ship really quickly, but I think we have somebody intent on a joker disruptive agenda. I don't think the system's got enough laws in place to prevent that from happening. So I would like to see more formal boundaries. And let's see, David, did you want to jump in?
On that third question, I actually wonder to what extent those final survey answers are people giving the socially acceptable answer and what the economists would call the revealed preferences in the monitoring of the TV debate. Just on the third point about Bannon, so Bob Woodward had this anecdote of Bannon went to Trump and said, "You've got to run as a populist." And Trump's like, "Yeah, a popularist." Bannon said, no, a populist. Trump's like, "Yes, a popularist." Bannon is one of the most self-aggrandizing people out there. If you look at his last 2 days, he got 17 people to a rally in, I think it was Kansas City. He's failing to fill not even rooms this size. He's failing to fill rooms classroom size. He's really promoted himself very successfully through very well-placed sources in the media as the Svengali. It's becoming increasingly apparent that it would have been impossible for him to put this into another candidate. It was Trump's style that actually carried it there. That style, I think, is actually ultimately a lot more important than the ideology. I think that, Trump's held a lot of different political positions. So have most people for most of their lives. Most people don't have time, room, inclination to consistent ideology.
There was a second question on the narrative of success. I think that's just part of the appeal of this style of politics, is that regardless of what you're doing, claim credit for it. But, Americans in particular do want to hear this thing that we're number one, and if we're not quite, we can regain it. So one of the things I've been surprised about is how well Trump's message has traveled, because it's really a message of decline, but behind that is a desire to be back on top, but he doesn't offer any real handles on how to do that.
Okay. On that unhappy note, let me wish you all a happy Halloween. And thank you for coming out tonight. And let us all thank our speakers.